This episode of Crosscut Talks is supported by Alaska Airlines.
Hello, and welcome to Crosscut Talks. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. When it comes to conveniences that many of us take for granted, food has long been at the top of the list. Not anymore. With the coronavirus lockdown, every one of us has had to rethink how we fill our plate. The ease of settling into a restaurant seat for a hot meal is a memory. Grocery shopping, meanwhile, has become a kind of high-stakes weekly ritual, requiring meticulous planning. The pandemic has also pulled back the curtain on how the food we eat makes it from factory farm to our table. The working conditions at meat processing facilities across the country have led to numerous clusters of COVID-19 cases. Some factories closed following these outbreaks, but concerns over the collapse of the food supply chain recently prompted President Trump to order that they be reopened. This week on Crosscut Talks, I'll be speaking with Leah Douglas about the toll that the virus is taking on the food industry. Leah is a staff writer at the Food and Environment Reporting Network, a nonprofit organization that has been independently tracking novel coronavirus cases in meatpacking and food processing plants. According to their count, the virus has infected more than 13,000 workers and killed 51. The numbers, she says, continue to climb. But first, I'm going to check in with staff reporter Lily Fowler about the numbers of infections and deaths being reported in Washington State and how they're shifting. Okay, on with the show. I've got Lily Fowler here. Lily is a staff reporter and the co-author, along with David Croman, of a story on the disproportionate impact that COVID-19 is having on people of color in Washington State, and in particular, on the Latino population. Hey, Lily.
Hi.
So I wanted to talk to you about this story. What do the latest numbers on COVID infections and deaths show us, both generally and then in particular for the populations that you're writing about?
At the beginning of the outbreak, we were seeing mostly the white population affected. It hit nursing homes hard in North Seattle, but that's changed now. And now we're seeing communities of color harder hit. And that's in particular true for the Latino community. The latest numbers that I saw, 31% of COVID cases were made up of Latinos, and that's compared to the 13% share of the overall population that they make up.
Wow, that is disproportionate.
Yeah.
I mean, to say the least. There were preliminary numbers that came out about a few weeks or a month ago that where we didn't see any of this disproportionate impact, which was surprising because we were seeing it in other cities, right? There were reports, especially amongst the Black population of a number of cities that were being harder hit. Why is it the Latino population that's being impacted the most right now?
Well, there's lots of reasons for that, lots of theories about why that might be. One is that they are having to go out and work. They work in an essential industry. They're having to go to work. They're having to ride public transportation to get to work. It's more common for them to live in households where there's multiple generations living in one small space. So you have multiple layers of a family going out and working and being exposed on public transportation and then coming home. And so it's not just say, well, I'm getting sick, but grandma getting sick. There's underlying health issues in the community, right? So especially with undocumented immigrants who might be scared off from seeing a doctor and have maybe felt that way for a number of years, especially since the Trump administration introduced this public charge rule where undocumented immigrants who use public benefits are more likely to be denied a green card or citizenship. So that had already been scaring this population and dissuading them from seeing health professionals. And so some of them may have already been neglecting their health, and then the pandemic hits, and so they're harder hit because they're just more vulnerable that way.
So again, this is a situation where we're seeing, you know, an instance where a population being cleaved from the sort of from society in a way, or the social services that they're being impacted. So this is sort of exacerbating what's already there.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. You know, I thought the story you shared about Luz Alvarez, which is an assumed name that we're providing the source, was pretty instructive in how the power dynamics between people can shape the course of the virus. Can you tell us about her?
She lives at a shelter in downtown Seattle with her daughter. I think she wanted to speak out because she was angry at both her employer and seemed to also really have a chip on her shoulder about the Trump administration and wanted to say some things about that. She was very disappointed in her employer for not warning her that, you know, this is a house cleaner. She went to go clean one of her clients' homes and she's standing in the kitchen, cleaning the kitchen. And she explained to me that that was one of the rooms she was always cleaned last before she finished the job. And she was in the kitchen cleaning when the lady of the house came down and was talking to somebody else. And she overheard her talking about how the doctor had cleared her that, you know, she was okay now, even though she had had coronavirus. And that was the first she had heard of it. She got really upset and left the house. This is a woman, by the way, who had had like a history of cancer, apparently. But Luz, the house cleaner, didn't know anything about the fact that she had also been diagnosed with coronavirus. And 5 days later, Luz came down with COVID. Although she never tested, she didn't test positive for it. She initially didn't seek out a test because she had heard that that was impossible to get. So she just kind of treated herself at home. But then her daughter got sick and her daughter did test positive. This was, you know, a few weeks later and her daughter was able to get a test. There was also apparently some kind of outbreak at the shelter she lives in. So there were public health officials there. In any case, they told her that it was most likely that she had passed it on to her daughter. And luckily, they're both recovered. But I think she was not only angry, but actually hurt. She said she was sad that her employer hadn't thought enough of her to let her know about that.
Yeah. So what's the trajectory here? Are people working on slowing the spread in communities of color and the Latino community in particular? Did your reporting reveal any sort of efforts to close the gap here?
That's exactly the question I posed to actually public health officials. And it's hard because these are inequities that have long existed. The pandemic is just exposing those. It's not like they're going to be able to undo years of damage, you know, in a few months or even a few years. They are doing a lot with trying to get the right information in the right hands and the right language. And just like in any other community, I think testing is huge. Testing was slow to roll out in all communities, but even slower to roll out in communities of color. And now that we're seeing those communities harder hit, I think there's even more urgency to get testing in those neighborhoods.
Hmm. Okay. Thanks so much for telling us a little bit about this story. You can read Lily's story and other stories at crosscut.com. And now for a word from our sponsor, Alaska Airlines. Alaska is taking care to the next level with a renewed commitment to providing a higher standard of cleanliness and safety. From airport check-in to boarding, from takeoff to landing, next level care involves COVID-19 preparedness plans and procedures developed with the FAA and CDC. This includes electrostatic disinfectant sprayers and onboard filters that remove 99.95% of airborne particles. Alaska is also putting proper social distancing procedures in place, requiring masks of employees and guests, providing sanitizing stations and wipes, reconfiguring seating arrangements, limiting in-flight services, and more. When you decide it's time to fly, Alaska is prepared to take your travels to the next level. Learn more at alaskaair.com/nextlevelcare. So I'm here with Leah Douglas now, a staff writer for the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Leah, welcome to Crosscut Talks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is it possible for you to go grocery shopping without thinking about what's happening in the food industry?
No, absolutely not. I joke a lot that I'm the worst dinner companion because if you ask me anything about any food question, I have an answer and it tends to be bad news. The experience of grocery shopping, you know, for all of us has become a very unprecedented, bizarre sort of experience. So it's definitely affected how I and how my household thinks about food procurement and where is our money going? How can we best support the local businesses that are struggling right now? And we're lucky to have that ability to be able to think about it like that, too.
I imagine that this is something that, like most of us, you intend to do, but maybe the crisis has focused those intentions into action, actually.
It's definitely made the whole process much more thoughtful, that's for sure. You know, we had already subscribed to a community-supported agriculture share and have for a long time, but we additionally planted a bunch of our own vegetables this year, which I know many people who have access to some outdoor space or even a windowsill are doing that. And we're also eating a lot more food at home. You know, our grocery shopping trips are much larger, which I know many people are experiencing in the absence of eating out. So there's just more opportunities to sort of splice apart the list. And, you know, some things make sense to buy from the bulk retailer. Some things we can buy from the locally owned organic store, and some things we'll wait for the CSA. And being able to menu plan like that has been, yeah, it definitely feels like a habit I want to keep up.
Yeah, it's the same here. And you know, when I go to the grocery store, because I'm reading these stories about the food industry and the disruption, I always go to the meat section and just kind of take stock of what's there and what isn't there. You know, I mean, I don't know if it's because of the disruption or because there was a run on chicken, but I always go and check it out. Do you do the same?
Definitely. There, at the very beginning of the pandemic, when we were just starting to understand some of the ways that it might affect our food supply, every time I went to the grocery store, I wanted to run around yelling, "Don't panic buy! You know, there's enough of everything. It's just stuck in transit somewhere." I didn't do that because, you know, people don't need to hear me yelling at the grocery store. But we're not facing immediate shortages. At the store, there might be a shortage, but it's not indicative of a national crisis that we should all be concerned we won't be able to feed ourselves. And definitely in this stage where there has been pretty good communication and I think pretty good public understanding around there's enough food, it's sort of making its way. We're seeing, you know, shelves be restocked now, but the meat counter is definitely a place where there's still this big open question. And I do, every time I'm out, it's sort of a mini reporting opportunity of what's going on here and how is what I'm writing about at the systemic level playing out in my neighborhood.
Well, let's talk about some of that work. In particular, I want to talk about the work that the Food and Environment Reporting Network has been doing to gather the numbers of COVID cases and COVID-related deaths in the industry. Why is it important to track these numbers?
Well, COVID-19 is really having a devastating impact on the nation's food system workers. At the beginning of the outbreak, we had a lot of national awareness growing around the exposure that grocery store workers have, other essential workers who have to continue going into work while some of us are able to work from home. And over time, we've seen that ripple effect of the virus really spreading through every stop on the supply chain from the farm to the retail operation, the retail store. So the past few weeks, there's been a really dramatic rise in the number of cases of COVID-19 among meatpacking plant workers and food processing plant workers. Increasingly, we're starting to see cases on farms affecting farm workers as well. And this is a hugely important thing to track for a few reasons. One is in the sort of general pursuit to understand this novel disease and how it's affecting our country. It's really important that these workers who are often low wage, many of whom are immigrants, who often don't have a voice in national media, be counted and their experiences be discussed in the media. And also, you know, there is an impact on our food supply for this many workers to be experiencing a dramatic illness all at once. And understanding the impact on how food reaches our table is an important thing to understand as well.
And how did this come onto your radar? What was the moment when you knew there was a problem?
That's a great question. The conditions at meatpacking plants have always been subpar in many cases. This was already a vulnerable workforce. And so when the pandemic began, and it became pretty clear pretty early on in the pandemic that these workplaces where workers are really standing shoulder to shoulder, the environments are cold or windy, damp, you know, it's really the perfect incubator for a virus. And there was not immediate action on the part of industry to jump out ahead of the pandemic and say, here's all the precautions we're taking. So sort of seeing that lack of immediate action and also understanding the conditions that workers already faced. It was something that I started tracking pretty soon into when the pandemic began. And we began our mapping project in the middle of April, which has allowed us to really visualize the spread of these outbreaks over time and to understand the severity, how quickly the cases have risen, and how many states are being impacted.
Why is the meatpacking industry the way that it is?
Well, the meatpacking industry has, over the past many decades, moved in general towards a trend of higher efficiency. One of the things that I write about a lot is corporate consolidation. So fewer and fewer companies in the sector. So there's been a lot of mergers and acquisitions. Those companies have gotten bigger and bigger, and they're producing food at a scale that is a higher scale and at a faster pace than we've ever had in American history. We're producing just a massive quantity of meat. And a lot of that meat, about 20%, is for export. So there's a real tie-in between the meat industry and our geopolitics, our trade relationships. There's a lot of our domestic production that is tied up in that. And additionally, just consumption of meat over time has gone up dramatically, and we've seen the industry respond to that. So the meat companies have really pushed over time to be able to process more meat faster, to be able to churn out more product. And that's had sort of a cascading effect where farmers are producing more animals, growing more animals for sale, and there's ramifications for workers at every step in that supply chain as well. So I would say it's really based in this trend of more and more power located in fewer and fewer companies and how those companies' demands and needs have sort of trickled down the supply chain.
Before the virus hit, was the industry becoming more safe or was it becoming less safe?
Well, there were definitely reports for a long time and have always been reports that the meatpacking industry exposes workers to really dangerous conditions. And there had been a few really influential reports in the 2000s and 2010s that looked at workers experiencing, you know, retribution for attempting to unionize, for speaking out about the workplace conditions. And it is inherently dangerous work, and it always has been. You know, many folks have been citing The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, which is in the 1920s, one of the first looks that many Americans had at the dangerous conditions at meatpacking plants. Workers are exposed to really grievous injuries as just sort of part of the work. So that was definitely the status quo. And as I said, this is a vulnerable workforce. You know, as many as a third of meatpacking plant workers are immigrants. Some of those immigrants are undocumented. So when we're thinking about how a pandemic like this affects people's livelihoods, and, you know, the types of government programs, for instance, that are rolled out to support certain types of workers or workplaces, those benefits aren't always passed on to workers who are in these most precarious roles. So that is something that has been exacerbated by the pandemic, but it's not something that was created by the pandemic.
So according to your reporting, we've seen 8 meatpacking plants and 5 food processing factories shut down. One of your sources said that we can still provide for the food supply chain, but, quote, it could get scary. What does scary mean here?
Well, that number of how many plants have closed has fluctuated enormously over the course of the few weeks that I've been really closely covering this issue. And part of the reason for that is companies have varied in their response time for when and how they decide to close a plant. In some cases, we've seen quite small facilities close plants even before there's a single case detected and just choose to test the entire workforce because that's their preventative measure. In other cases, we've seen outbreaks reach the hundreds, high hundreds, before companies take extreme measures like idling the plant and testing the workforce and installing barriers and things like that that would protect the workers. And a major sort of turning point in that calculus of how many plants were closed was an executive order signed by President Trump on April 28th, which invoked the Defense Production Act to essentially keep meatpacking plants open. And the order essentially delegated authority to the Department of Agriculture to figure out how to get meatpacking plants back online. On April 28th, there were somewhere around 16 meatpacking plants that were offline. And in that week, we were hearing estimates like 40% of our pork production could be offline. That was reaching a point where if your primary concern is how much pork are we producing, are our pork production figures keeping up with the demand that we charted out for the beginning of 2020, then that's a scary situation. At the same time, there were many thousands of workers whose lives are being endangered to keep what was the production that was online still going. And the executive order put essentially the needs and desires of the industry ahead of what was being asked by labor advocates and unions to say, we need to keep these plants closed in the interest of protecting workers and public health. Since the executive order, almost all of those meatpacking plants have since reopened. And today, when I was recalculating which plants are currently closed, there are just three that are still offline. Now, of course, since April 28th, cases among workers have also risen by more than 200%. So the implications for the workforce, it indicates that it's not great, and we'll have to wait and see, now that we have all these meatpacking plants back online, what the implications are going forward.
So essentially, the executive order, which invokes the Defense Production Act, it can't be overruled by any local leaders. Local leaders can't order a plant closed, right? So what has the response been to the order by these leaders, or even leaders within the industry? Are there people saying we need to keep these plants closed, and is there any recourse for them?
That's a great question. I haven't seen anything to indicate that there's been major pushback against the executive order. I would partially attribute that to the fact that the meat companies are supportive of the executive order and want to see the plants back online. You know, when I say the meat companies, I'm referring to the biggest companies in the industry. So it's Tyson Foods, JBS, Cargill. Those companies have come out in support of this type of federal action and explicitly asked for this type of federal action. There are other companies that are meat packers that are at a smaller scale that are making their own decisions about how to support workers, how to implement testing, and there is a variety of responses. However, those three companies or four companies that are at the top, I think they're responsible for maybe 50-60% of the plants that have outbreaks. So predominantly, when I'm referring to how meat companies respond, I'm thinking about that majority.
But is anyone saying that these workers should not be compelled to work? Are there any voices out there insisting that maybe the food supply just needs to slow down a little bit? Americans maybe need to eat a little bit less meat rather than having these workers go back to the factories?
There definitely is a substantial voice, at least from the private sector. For instance, companies that make plant-based meat alternatives, you know, to point out this is an inherent issue with the meat supply chain. It sort of echoes what we were talking about a few minutes ago of these are conditions that already existed and are just being exacerbated. The way the meat industry is structured is predicated and based on these certain workplace conditions that have always been subpar for a large subset of workers. I don't know that I've seen political call for the workers to not have to work, although that may be out there. But I think especially there has been a strong demand around paid sick leave, paid time off. And I believe that the demands in most cases have exceeded what the meat companies have provided to the workers. So there's still a gap, as far as to my knowledge, between the typical demand from, say, a union that represents meatpacking workers and what workers are actually experiencing.
So Trump's order also calls for protective equipment. I don't know how that's been rolled out or enforced at all, but I wonder, is it possible to make these factories safe enough to reduce the level of transmission to the point where we can return to some semblance of normalcy?
Well, that's definitely the million-dollar question confronting the industry this week is, you know, we had the executive order bring all the plants back online. The vast majority of plants that have been affected by COVID are back in full operation, or at least partial operation. And it's truly unprecedented, and week to week, the information and foundation changes completely. So we know we have over 13,000, nearly 14,000 workers in the food processing sector who have been diagnosed. That's certainly an undercount. We don't actually have anywhere a full count because of how information has been disseminated, of how many workers are sick and how many workers have died of COVID-19. So the meatpacking plants are embarking on a mission to attempt to restore 100% or close to 100% of our output without endangering workers. The evidence that I've seen from the past several weeks indicates that that's extremely difficult to accomplish, and the types of measures that we need to control to contain the outbreak nationally are the same measures that we need to contain the outbreak in these plants. So testing for every, you know, worker and complete PPE that doesn't need to be reused. Some factories are implementing physical barriers between workers. Those are all steps that need to be taken in tandem, is my understanding, to effectively contain the outbreak. I would say that my reporting and the reporting I've seen elsewhere indicates that there's not universal adoption of those strategies. So there's definitely a strong possibility, I would say a likelihood, that we're going to continue to see these cases rising over the next several weeks as the industry struggles to figure out how to appropriately contain the outbreaks.
So we've talked about a number of different players here, workers, politicians, factory owners, consumers. But there's one other group that we haven't talked about, and that's actually the animals. You wrote something in an earlier report here. I think this was a couple weeks ago when the plants were closed, or more of them were closed. But you write that plant closures have resulted in a backlog of animals who may need to be killed on the farm. I think you said the number was 700,000. Why can't these animals be kept alive?
That's a great question. And I think this is an element of the food supply and farm supply chain that is really being revealed to most people for the first time. Essentially, what happens when these processing plants close down or reduce capacity, the number of animals that they would typically take in, they can no longer take in, of course. So those animals stay on the farm where they've been, you know, being raised to eventually go to the plant for slaughter. Feeding those animals continuously without a certain sell date or slaughter date is very expensive. Hogs in particular, you know, they're large animals, feeding them is expensive, and it would essentially create a impossible financial situation for the farmer to have an indefinite backlog there. We've also seen this among chickens. All these animals are meant to be slaughtered at a specific time. There's sort of a narrow window when they're the appropriate age and size to be slaughtered, and beyond a certain point, they're no longer in their premium condition for that. So we have seen the slaughter of chickens as well. That's another thing that we're seeing, another domino, let's say, that we're seeing sort of fall in real time, and there will be sort of continued conversation about it and issues that will arise if we continue to see plants close. That will only exacerbate how many animals are sort of stuck on the farm.
Oh, man. That's a lot of hogs. We do not understand the scope of the food industry that feeds us until it becomes disrupted in this way. And I wonder what impact that could have if we do go into a period of sustained closure. Is this a transformative moment for the industry?
Well, I think it's definitely transformative in terms of the public's awareness of how this industry operates and some of the gruesome details that reporters and advocates have researched and pointed out for many years, and workers have amplified for many years. But it is the meat supply and meat supply chain system is one that inherently does have some sort of gruesome elements, and not to trivialize. I mean, of course, the situations that workers face are inexcusable in many cases. But this whole pandemic allows a sort of a lens into what types of conditions is a farmer grappling with, you know, on the farm when there is some sort of supply chain disruption. What can we learn about politics of how the policies that shape how meat production happens? One interesting story I saw come out today in Reuters was looking at the number of meatpacking plants that are being brought online that are actually producing for export, and how that had caused some outrage of, you know, we went through all this, we reopened the plants, and those workers are risking their lives to, you know, make food for someone else. And that's a reality of our meat supply, that a significant portion is produced for export, and we also import a significant percentage. Those are all details that are now being discussed at a much, much greater length than they ever have. So there's definitely an opportunity in terms of educating the public. And also there's an opportunity, one would hope, for some systemic reforms, especially to address those issues that, you know, workers and also farmers have been instigating around for many years about the inequities inherent to the supply chain. Whether or not the companies that, again, control this sector will do that of their own volition, will make those changes of their own volition, I would say remains to be seen. And past evidence wouldn't suggest that that would be their first instinct. But there's many, many proposals being sent around the Hill to members of Congress, that from many different types of advocacy groups and many voices, to say, you know, here's an opportunity to do things differently. So the proposals are out there, and it will be sort of an ongoing process to see if any of them are adopted.
Well, you've certainly given me a lot to think about on my next harrowing trip to the grocery store. So, Leah Douglas, thank you so much for coming on Crosscut Talks. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was engineered by Rusty Bacall and produced by Jake Newman. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.